we have so much health disparity now in medicine and healthcare, where just because of the color of my skin and my socioeconomic background, I can have a completely different experience in medical settings. So if we haven't solved that issue now, what do you think will happen when we have these fancy precision medicine therapies available, right? Those issues are going to still be there. So, you know, even myself, some of my concerns sometimes that it feels like, or I worry that I'm working on things that people that look like me won't be able to benefit from.
Hey, and welcome to the Millennial Health Podcast. I'm Dr. Jayshree Allen, a board-certified family physician who's passionate about the health of my fellow millennials. I know we're booked and busy, but your first wealth is your health. So I'm taking some of my most important health messages and bringing them here to you on this podcast. My goal is to share some valuable information and draw awareness to some important health topics, but I encourage you to please consult your physician for personalized medical advice. Today on the Millennial Health Podcast, we're joined by Dr. Kamir Ricketts. He's an ardent advocate for science and innovation, and an even greater advocate for the development of all of the Caribbean. He earned his PhD in computational biology and medicine from Weill Cornell Medicine in 2020, and is now a bioinformatics scientist. He is also the founder of the Minds of Initiative, which launched their Minds of Jamaica mentorship platform in 2019. Dr. Ricketts, welcome to Millennial Health.
Thank you for having me. Thank you for having me. Happy to be here.
Yes, such a pleasure. So, you know, I mentioned to you before, there is an entire ecosystem in healthcare. You know, but typically we hear about the doctor and the nurse that you go to see in the clinic or in the hospital. Yeah. Not often do we hear about our bioinformatics scientists, right? Yeah. So I wanted to hear a little about your professional journey and kind of how you got into medicine, and particularly this path into medicine.
Yeah. Well, I was always interested in science. Remember, even primary school, that was always an area that fascinated me, you know, all the little experiments that they'll have you do at that age. So when I got into high school, I was thinking I would go down that path, but wasn't sure what, you know, research looked like. And if anybody knows, once you're interested in science in Jamaica, a lot of people push you to be like a doctor, like a physician, MD. But the idea of being a physician never really appealed to me that much. And especially after participating in a summer research program at University of West Indies, really got exposed to like microbiology, biotechnology, all these different facets in within the sciences. I really, really thought that, you know, being a research scientist would be what would be interesting to me. But then I also got into like IT. And the computer science and the programming and all that. So that became an interest of mine. And for a long time during high school, I would have this dilemma, right? Like which part? Because in my mind, they're very different. They either go and be a, you know, in the life sciences, be a biologist or chemist or so on. Or you choose the IT and computer science route and you become a software developer, right? Network administrator, systems engineer. They're very different paths in my mind. So I didn't know how I was going to choose, but I knew I liked both of them, and my parents were always big on, if you have interest, then try to explore them to the fullest extent of your abilities for as long as you can, right? So I took extra classes. You know, I was going to high school in the day for life sciences and taking science subjects. In the evenings, I would do IT and computer science subjects. And even when I was choosing a major in college, it was almost like a flip of the coin, because I was like, either I major in microbiology, because I really like microbiology, and minor in computer science, or a major in computer science and minor in microbiology. And I ended up going with, you know, major as microbiology, minor computer science when I started out. And it was my first year at university. I went to University of Georgia, that just kind of a random conversation with a professor. I was telling him about my dilemma, still not being able to choose which one I want to be. And he was like, well, you know, why do you have to choose, right? There's something called bioinformatics, computational biology, that, you know, allows you to combine both of those, right? The quantitative side of computer science and the programming with the scientific investigation that you find in the life sciences and microbiology and so on. So that really fascinated me. Went home, researched all I could about bioinformatics, and really started to discover how powerful it is and how it play a bigger role over the coming years within the space of medicine. All right, so that really got me down that path. I started doing undergraduate research in university. I started in the lab of Dr. John Maurer working on Mycoplasma gallisepticum, but I was really getting introduced into bioinformatics, analyzing, you know, DNA sequencing data and RNA sequencing data for that organism. And that really just solidified it. Like, yeah, I think this is something I could do. So when time came, you know, after college to move on to the next step, I knew I wanted to do a PhD in computational biology. I kind of decided that I wanted to move away from, I guess, the microbiology somewhat and really get into cancer and how we can apply, you know, bioinformatics and genomics within cancer. So I really was focused on finding, you know, a faculty or institutions that was really strong in that. So that's how I ended up here at Weill Cornell Medicine, because it was, you know, huge resource and a lot of faculty here focus on tackling problems within cancer genomics and that kind of stuff. So I ended up in the lab of Dr. Iman Ajasulia here in Institute of Precision Medicine at Weill Cornell Medicine, and there's this kind of history.
Wow, that is such an interesting journey. Honestly, I don't think we hear those sorts of stories enough, you know, even just outside of medicine. I think, you know, if you think of anything legal, it's just a lawyer or maybe just a lawyer. But there's so many other ways to enter an industry. So I love that you shared that story. Can I build a little, though, on your passion for science and innovation? I was particularly struck, too, when you decided to make the switch to cancer and how you can apply your career to that. Talk to us a little about that phase of the journey, how you decided to do that.
It really came about unexpectedly. So I was wrapping up a lot of my undergraduate research work. You know, it was beginning of senior year, finishing up in the microbiology lab that I was working in. And then we had a bioinformatics department at University of Georgia, and a professor there had just published a book, and I think I must have seen it on some news release, press release from the school, that he published a book in cancer bioinformatics. So I never really ventured on that. So I kind of looked, I thought it was cool. I requested, you know, cold email, requested a meeting with him, kind of spoke to him about, I was like, oh, it'd be cool to just work in his lab for maybe a semester of my senior year and see what cancer bioinformatics is about. And so we had a meeting. It was really cool, but he wasn't really interested in taking on a senior in his lab because, you know, it was just like a really short-term situation. So I kind of came back at him with a counter-proposal. I was like, okay, that's fair. But if I buy your book and I read your book, would you be willing to at least take like a 30-minute to an hour meeting with me once a week to just discuss the things I cover in the book, right? So he was like, okay, sure, we'll do that. So my senior year, I really kind of just got his book, started reading. We discussed in his office, you know, things there are many things I didn't understand. And he would, you know, explain them to me, describe a lot of his theories and so on. Throughout that process, it really just really solidified that, yo, this is even, you know, there's so many areas, you know, so much room for innovation, for questioning and answering and finding solutions in that space. It's such a hard problem, but such a fascinating problem as well. I was like, oh, maybe this is where I should apply my time and my developing skills. So that's really how we came about. It was very, you know, I didn't really expect that, but I saw that book, met him. I was like, let me read this cancer book. And then it was that interaction that made me choose to pursue cancer at the PhD level. You know, in some extent, it kind of feels like I should have done more work before switching, but that's really what it was.
No, can we talk about perseverance and persistence and knocking on doors for a minute? Yeah. Because, you know, I just love how you said you didn't take the first no as an answer. You said, okay, well, if you're not going to take me on as a senior, here's another proposal for you. Even that is so bold to ask this professor for 30 minutes. But can we talk a little about that, though? Because honestly, that is a strategy that determines whether people make it or don't make it at times. Yeah. Just having that boldness to push forth through a no initially, you know?
Yeah, 100%. I think in many areas of life, you have to find the guts to really just come on, at least be creative, right? Okay. So if you get a no, is either you're going to push back and say, no, I want a yes. Or you say, okay, maybe that original proposal garnered a no. How can I change a little bit? Come up, you know, it's a negotiation in a lot of situations, right? Or at least finding out what was the root of that no. So if somebody tell me no, I always want to understand kind of why. That's why I hate kind of application processes where you just, you know, oh, we're rejecting you and that's it. Like, just at least give me an idea. Was it my resume? Was it strong? You know what? Give me some actionable feedback that I can then use when I come again and come harder, right? And try a lot harder. So.
I love that. Love that so much. You had touched on something earlier that I want to circle back to. So this topic of individualized medicine, right?
Yeah.
Let's talk about this a little bit more. You know, I, as a physician, clinician who sees patients, you know, I didn't hear about that term until I was in residency. I trained at the Mayo Clinic and they have a center that focuses on that there, you know? So I honestly didn't know too much about this. So can you share with our audience, what is individualized medicine? Why is this even relevant to someone who's a millennial?
Yeah. And it's a term that I, you know, got introduced to as I was kind of, you know, going through my academic journey. And you realize it's just a thinking where we want to try to move away or try to replace the current paradigm in medicine that some might describe as a one-size-fits-all model where a lot of therapies and a lot of interventions are developed for the average person, right? We're like, we expect the average person to respond in this way, so that's why we prescribe it. And because of the Human Genome Project, we now have a lot more information about the genetic makeup of anybody, really, of individuals. And we also have a lot more information, a lot more ways to analyze that data much faster, right? So the idea is that we can then learn how to develop therapies that are tailored for a particular individual's genetic background, right? The genetic state of that person, but also factoring in environmental factors and so on. So we want to use kind of these advanced biomedical tools now, molecular testing, genetic testing, all these things and like data analytics to help clinicians better predict treatment and prevention strategies for their patients. And that's really where it comes from, because in a lot of cases, you know, you'll find at a simple level, you'll find some people that, you know, if they have a headache, some people be like, well, Tylenol doesn't work for me, I'm an Advil person, and so on. So, and you know, in a simple sense, that's why it is finding out what works for you because of your unique characteristics and traits that you have genetically, environmentally, and so on, and really being able to determine that or figure that out much faster in a clinical setting to then basically improve the chance of your survival, right? If we can create interventions and therapies that are unique to you. And a lot of times, you know, I guess it's a debate too. So a lot of people move away from terms like individualized medicine and personalized medicine, and they're more use precision medicine because they think it implies that, okay, every treatment that you develop is going to be specific to one person. But that's not true, right? We'll take in those genetic factors in play. There might be a subset of people that, you know, any personalized treatment can benefit, but that's really what it's about. And I think it's a transition or a space a lot of areas are moving to. So I always think about even skincare and hair care. A lot of these companies now, you go online and you're putting in your zip code and your specific, you know, do you have wavy hair, curly hair, all that kind of stuff. That a lot of companies are realizing that if I can get as much information about you as possible and what makes you unique, we can then assign the right fit, the best fit, you know, for you in terms of what our product is. And that's what we're trying to do to some extent with medicine, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. So of course, those are all of the good things, but with all good things, there's always another side of it. So what are some of the arguments on the opposite side of this that you've heard that are quite concerning?
I think there's a lot of things. And at face value, the first kind of thing that you think about is, how is that information being protected? So with this move to precision medicine, I believe in the next, you know, 15 years or so, I would guess that we're going to be in a situation where a lot of people are going to have their genetic profile, you know, in their docket in the hospital, just like how, you know, kind of your readouts, you know, blood pressure, all those things are taken, you know, we'll have that in file. And that is something that is nerve-wracking for a lot of people, right? Like, you know, your whole genome will be kind of unfile. How are we protecting that data? How are we anonymizing that data? And a big issue is that because we're learning so much, you know, in this space year to year, sometimes what counts as anonymous data 5 years ago is no longer anonymous data, right? And there's a whole lot of other questions around, okay, if an insurance company can get a hold of this information now, and we see that you have a gene that predisposes you to a particular condition or, you know, increase your risk, do they count that as a pre-existing condition and therefore not cover it? So, like, you know, there are things like that we really have to, they're important questions that we really have to take care of, you know, from a scientific level, from a policy level, kind of all through, you know, data privacy is going to be so important, especially now. I think recently we've had an issue with, you know, eroding trust in science, eroding trust in data privacy. A lot of these big companies are now, you know, kind of in hot water around that. And none of those things help in terms of making, you know, precision medicine a reality. And then the other side of it too is that we have so much health disparity now in medicine and healthcare, where, you know, just because of the color of my skin and my socioeconomic background, I can have a completely different experience in medical settings. So if we haven't solved that issue now, what do you think will happen when we have these fancy precision medicine therapies available, right? Those issues are going to still be there. So, you know, even myself, some of my concerns sometimes that it feels like, or I worry that I'm working on things that people that look like me won't be able to benefit from, you know? And that's a real thing. So there are a lot of issues that still have to be addressed before we can make this, you know, it has a lot of promise, you know, it's nice to talk about the promise of it and so on, but there are definitely a very real side to it that we have to really
think about. Going. No, that is so true. And, you know, sometimes I have those same thoughts to myself whenever I'm doing something. I'm like, how exactly is this benefiting, you know, the people that do look like me, who I know are lacking some of these resources? You know, I think about too, even like my grandmother, to think that, you know, I'm a doctor, my mother is a nurse, right? But my grandmother had such poorly controlled type 2 diabetes, but was still getting up, going to work, doing all these different things and not having the time to go to her doctor's appointment to get the care that she needed. You know, it was go to the ER at night because she didn't have to go to work at that point in time, not take a day off to go to the doctor because it's an hourly job. You know, if you don't go to work, you don't get paid. So like, to even think like that, you know, that people we know in our direct families, you know, struggle with some of these disparities.
No, yeah. And I think, you know, because our research, we're applying our tools and our analysis to cohorts of patients, right? Mm-hmm. And currently in genomics, a lot of those cohorts majority of them are European descent. So the genome, the DNA that we're analyzing, DNA that we're trying to really, you know, unlock and figure out how these particular genes bring across certain disease or onset of certain illnesses or so on. There's a chance that the answer that we provide really only apply to that cohort, which is majority European, because that's kind of how science works, right? We can't really just assume that, you know, okay, we tested and we investigated a cohort that is 80% European, but we expect it to just, you know, be able to apply to any public, because there's documented proof that there are certain genes and traits that are very population specific that affects how different populations interact with different kinds of drugs and treatments. So that's really one of the big issues. So now I think we have an increased awareness of that, you know, with everything that's going on, you know, science is not precluded. So we've had a lot of efforts now come around where they're trying to be better and build more diverse cohorts that we can then do research on. A lot of work that I hope to be a part of involve that as well, is really, really trying to get more people to take part in research. But again, the issue is now convincing, you know, minority individuals to, hey, let us use your genome for research and so on, when there's such a mistrust of science, especially in that community. So it's a tough problem to overcome, right?
Absolutely. That is what I just wanted to bring up right now. How do we, right, alleviate the fears of, you know, some of our minoritized communities who have genuine reasons for having this level of distrust in the medical community? It is warranted. Yeah. There have been, you know, things that have happened, unfortunately, to kind of stir these sorts of feelings. And also, mm-hmm. you know, everybody talks about, like, you know, Tuskegee and Henrietta Lacks and all of that. But just talk about today, right? You know, the mm-hmm. experiences of, you know, whether it's, you want to talk about Black women and maternal care. I mean, the list will go on and on, no matter where we start, what disease process we try to use, right? So just to talk about, like, you know, the disparities now, that still impacts. People don't want to be experimented on or mm-hmm. taken advantage of, or, you know. So what can we say to our, because I'm Black, you're Black, right? Mm-hmm. We're both in the sciences. We are both huge supporters of science, and we would both like to see more people of color in these research studies so that we can better, like you mentioned before, you know, determine outcomes that are going to work for us. You know, what can we say to encourage our people?
I think the best or the most impactful way for us to get to a place where we're seeing more of our people in these research studies is having more of our people controlling these research studies, you know, actually carrying out the research and so on. I think that's why, you know, a lot of my interest is in getting, you know, more and more representation in these rooms, you know, being decision makers, right? Because that's really what it is. Like, once you see that somebody who looks like you or from your background are in these rooms making these calls, one that alone can bring a sense of ease, right? Because you feel like you have this shared interest, and they're not someone who is going to try and take advantage of you. I think that is really where a lot of it stems from. Is just We don't see a lot of people that look like us controlling these studies or carrying out these things, or people that look like us that are in these spaces are not front and center, right? They're not in the public eye. They're not getting the shine that they rightly deserve. So I think pushing for more representation, more equity in that space. So you see a lot of institutions now are trying to, you know, increase number of you know, or change how they hire and how they go about hiring to make sure that they're really promoting diversity, you know, racial diversity, gender diversity, all those kind of facets, because it's important. It helps. Like, I know when I'm in any kind of environment and I know I see people that look like me, there's a level of subconscious calm or comfort that comes with it. It's just, you know, you feel like there's this trust, that assumed trust to some extent, and I think that's what we need more of, because it's real. And I think What you have to do is not dismiss, right? Not dismiss the concerns of people or be like, oh, come on, you're being ridiculous. Because it's very real and it's very serious. So that's why I try to, you know, be someone who is front and center, who other people can see doing the work, show that we can be in this space, especially coming from Jamaica, is a small caravan, because, you know, we want to be the ones driving this kind of work, right?
Yes. So I want to talk about Minds Of, because that is huge. I'm really impressed by this project. So you launched the Minds Of Jamaica mentoring program back in 2019. Mm-hmm. But outside of just Jamaica, this is a much broader initiative. So can you share a little about that?
Yeah. So Minds Of Initiative and Minds Jamaica really started out of an observation I made, right? So I something I realized. I guess I always knew this, but I realized that a lot of students in Jamaica, because that's where I was at the time when I realized, I gave a lecture in Jamaica, and just from the questions that were being asked, that these were university students, it was very clear that a lot of them did not have any kind of relationship with someone who was actively doing the job, the occupation, the career part that they, you know, are on, right? That they want to aspire to do. And you can see or hear in the kind of questions they're asking, or how desperate they were for some form of information, guidance, and so on. And it's not easy. You realize it's not a problem that is unique to Jamaica, but, you know, I realize that depending on where you were born and grew up, where you grew up in Jamaica, the kind of professionals that you're around, the kind of people that you're around is vastly different, right? If you grew up in St. Catherine versus Kingston and so on. So there needed to be a way. I really came back with the question of how can I help a lot of these students get access to the people that they need, because it really was bothering me, because there were so many questions that I couldn't answer. Like, somebody was there, because a lot of students really connected with the idea that I was able to combine my interests, because students know, a lot of them are, they're, you know, they're so creative, but they're also, you know, analytical and all that kind of stuff, and they're searching for ways to combine those interests because they don't want to pick, right? So a lot of them really connected with the fact that I found something that combined my interests instead of me choosing one. But they would ask me a question like, oh, how do I combine neuroscience and music? And I'm like, I know there's some part of neuroscience research that they use music, you know, music therapy or something, but I really don't know much about it, right? So I really couldn't give them actionable advice in that moment. So I came back and I was like, I wish there's somewhere I could just tap into really quickly to like direct that student to somebody who could, you know, who was a lot more knowledgeable than me and how they can combine neuroscience and music. And that's what kind of catalyzed the creation of Minds of Jamaica, because I was like, okay, we want to create a space, a platform now where any Jamaican student or any student, right, can go on and get and find the people that they need to speak to, right, and make it easy, make it open, because I think a lot of times we create these barriers to entry because, you know, we want our programs to feel, you know, very elite or hard to get into and so on. Like a lot of universities, you know, they pride themselves on how low their acceptance rate is or and stuff like that, which So I really wanted to see, okay, how can we make it easier, right? Rather than harder to find those people. And to my surprise, there were so many other people who were willing to sign up, you know, as mentors, as career mentors. So we call all our career mentors the Minds, right? So they're a group of young professionals who are really making themselves available to our platform to speak with students. Because one big issue is that a lot of students feel like they can't reach out to people. They feel kind of awkward, you know, they're shy and that kind of stuff. So we really want to do the hard part. We're saying, okay, we went out, we vetted these people, we determined that they're the kind of person who would want to talk to her. So you don't have to worry about the whole thing of like, oh, would this person even, you know, want to bother to talk to me? So your only job is to just be present, you know, reach out and soak in information as much as possible. And that's really what the vision has been, is just democratize access to career mentorship and then opportunities now. So now we can use this platform also as a vehicle to expose students to new career areas, because I want, as being a part of Minds Jamaica, we want every student to kind of find the tools and discover the knowledge necessary to be more strategic about their career decision, right? And, you know, in some cases, find out things they would have never had, you know, otherwise earlier, so they can, oh, this might not be the right path for me, even though I thought it did. Let me find something else. Or, oh, yes, for sure, this is where I want to go. Let's go down this path. And, you know, we've been able to really have a lot of, you know, early successes, a lot of early feedback, and we're constantly trying to, you know, innovate and change. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we built our own platform from the ground up that, you know, mm-hmm. the student engage is completely free, because that's, you know, been something we're trying to.
How can they find it? Anyone listening right now?
Yeah, so it's easy to find. If you just go to themindsof.com, mm-hmm. you'll be able to find it, or find us on Instagram at Minds of Jamaica, mm-hmm. and you'll be able to tap in from there. Right.
Okay. Thank you so much, Dr. Ricketts, for joining us here at Millennial Health. This was a very informative conversation, actually, and a lot for us to think about and a lot for us to
listen
to it. Yes. Besides the website and the Instagram, how else can anyone get in contact with you if they are so inclined, especially hearing your moving story here?
Yeah, I guess you can find me on LinkedIn. I'm easy to find on LinkedIn. Okay. Just type my name. I think I have a unique name, so you can find me pretty quickly. Or Instagram as well, or Twitter. Both of them is at Camille Ricketts. So again, pretty easy to find me and reach out.
Thank you. Thank you so much for joining us.
I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for joining me today on the Millennial Health Podcast. Though my goal is to share some valuable information and draw awareness to some important health issues, I encourage you to please consult your physician for personalized medical advice. I hope this information was beneficial to you. And if so, please subscribe to the Millennial Health Podcast and share with your friends. Please also leave us a review. If you have questions or comments, feel free to reach out on Instagram or Twitter at Dr. Jay Sheree, DrJayShere.